the development of the harbor, and I was retained to talk about subsidence, because there is a small bowl of subsidence at Huntington Beach. Well, I would say that that is my library, mostly my product of my authorship, with some exceptions, and that is the, to me, you hold it, would you hold that? This is to me a, an important, I think it's quite important, in that it is by far the best explanation of the anatomy, the cause, the effect, aspects of it. This, you can't go any place else and get the whole picture, which, through the various publications, the various aspects of it, I carry. An immodest statement, but I don't mind making it an immodest statement. That's the way I feel about it. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I want to apologize. The other day, you said, well, could I ask questions of me? Impolitely, rudely, in fact, said, well, if you can ask penetrating questions. That was rude of me, because I didn't feel that way. I would say, well, I didn't mean it. I apologize.
And I don't know any technical questions. I'm not even a civil engineer. Okay. <laughs> So I don't know the technical questions. The one question that came to me, when you said that people knew who had written that, the line, a tedious description. Does that mean that most people who write technical reports of that sort lack a sense of humor?
They would never, nobody would write a tedious about their own thing. It just isn't done. You wouldn't say, well, the following is a tedious so-and-so, well, I'm writing it. They would say, I guess the conventional reply would be, well, if it's tedious, don't write it. Well, it was necessary, and it was appropriate as far as I was concerned, but I think most people like this chap thought it was frightfully unconventional for anybody to say, the following chapter is a tedious so-and-so. Well, it was, and I didn't mind forewarning him, and I didn't mind admitting it, but here was the first time out, it was necessary. I guess even if you need to be tedious, you shouldn't tell anybody.
Tell me about your background. Where were you born?
Oh, Seattle, Washington, year 1908, January 25th. And the minute my grandfather died and left my mother about $20,000, she got a divorce. Boom, right now. And we moved, mother and son, to San Francisco.
What did your grandfather do if he was in Seattle?
No. Well, they, my father and mother, both came from Texas. My mother from Temple, Texas, which is an interior railroad terminal, and my father from Galveston. If you're interested in the... the story, family story, which may be apocrypha. Captain Wilcox, which was my mother's grandfather's name, was a second or third son of a shipbuilder in south of England, Cornwall. Pirates of Penzance came from there. When he came of age, he became master and owner of his own vessel, was captured by the pirate Lafitte off the coast of Veracruz, sailed with him as a lieutenant for 7 or 8 years, and was pardoned for helping defend New Orleans against the British of the War of 1812. And the Wilcoxes on my mother's side were very fruitful people. They had gumption. On the father's side, the Laws were cotton buyers from Sheffield, Liverpool, the English-Scottish border, who settled in Galveston as the biggest cotton export in the world. That was the cotton, sale cotton, and they bought cotton for the mills in England. And they settled down. Well, they were kind of stuffy people. They weren't my father. He was a civil service in the city of Galveston, ran for office of some kind, was resoundingly defeated, and they moved from Galveston to Seattle, where he became chief clerk of the treasury, of the city treasury's office. And he had a green eye shade and black overshoes. And when he went down to ask about taxes or so and so, he had great big books there. You'd open up and you'd find your lot and do something or other. And he was a civil servant and not energetic. Like my, on my mother's side, they had people of exploits and energy who didn't know. So, we lived in San Francisco, a divorced mother and dying son. And I might say that my mother was just an absolute amazing in terms of motherhood and motherhood. They say that Jewish women, Jewish mothers, have an intensity of motherhood that is frightening. The intensity of motherhood comes out of a Jewish mother that is awe-inspiring in intensity. Well, I think my mother was awe-inspiring in her intensity of raising dear Janet. I was taken for sure that I knew and could classify Oriental rugs, and that I knew a certain amount of chaos. And we would go practice at home with several knives and forks, and we'd go to the best hotel in which there were finger bowls and six knives and three qualified spokes. And I was supposed to in training. And I was truly in the sense of modern Buffett. We didn't have very much money. My mother married a fellow who didn't have very much money, and we had to move to Southern California. She absolutely cataloged and found out all the best high schools. We moved into the poorest section of South Pasadena, because at that time, South Pasadena probably had the most excellent school in which 85% of the graduates went to college as a prep school, whereas ordinary high schools were on the place, and that would be 1927-26. And we're lucky if a third went to college. And I was bussed in the sense that you would bus ethnic groups from poor, the barrios, to the good section of town. Well, I was bussed into South Pasadena by my mother, who was determined that dear Jane was going to graduate from university or else. And I took piano lessons for 7 years. I was named after Jan Ignace Paderewski, because my mother played the piano, and she thought dear Jan at least should play the piano. I was at least obedient, and for 7 years I practiced. I didn't have a shred of desire or talent or anything else. In fact, I sat with that goddamn metronome. The tick, tick, tick of a metronome still makes me sick at my stomach, because I couldn't count very well, and I was chained to the horrid little thing. And the point there is that conscientious parents can be a real menace, a real menace. And I'm the product of a real menace on the part of a mother who had strong will and obedient son. I might say that I enjoyed my mother very much. We talked like she was an office holder in the League of Women Voters for all of her adult years. And we would breakfast, lunch, and even dinner, breakfast, dinner, depending upon time, we would talk politics. And we enjoyed each other, no question. And there came a time in life when I knew that I was destined to be a mother's boy. I was positive. I might say that that kind of a thing is brutal. It's really, it isn't amusing, it isn't anything. I suppose they ought to teach. Now, a way of teaching boys with dominant mothers how to escape from the dominant mother. They don't teach you that. I know they don't. Well, they should have taught me how to do it. So I think I did it in a kind of a brutal way. One reason I took up engineering is I didn't want to have a thing to do with anything my mother knew anything about, because if she knew about it, she'd tell me how to do it and dominate me. I knew for sure. She believed in education, travel, and frugal living. If you came to her house, she gave you a half a paper napkin for luncheon. She tore them in half and said, you don't need one. And if you went out of the room with an electric light on or a faucet dripping, you heard about it. She saved her money real tight. And then, like, for instance, she took me to Europe on what would be a grand tour before I graduated from high school. My stepfather was in the transportation business, so we had quite a few passes. And there we traveled all over, and again, that was a real concentration of mother and son. And she would read Baedeker and into the night, and next morning get up and visit a cathedral just full of Baedeker and the cathedral. And me, by that time, I didn't have that intensity of thought. And I guess she would be 40 and I was 18, and I think she walked my shoes and feet just clear off with the intensity of reading Baedeker all night and gone. Well, time passes on. I went to high school. All the teachers said, Jan, don't look out the window. I was a daydreamer. I didn't work. I could get good grades in all of the conversational courses, and I developed a deep admiration for mathematics, physics, and chemistry because I couldn't get it, and I felt it really bothered me when my associates, peers, would talk mathematics and chemistry, and I couldn't speak the language a bit, so I said, I'll have to take that. And I had to work at that. The conversational courses, whatever they were, why, that was no problem. And I graduated from the University of California.
How did you decide to go to Berkeley?
Oh, people had said that's the finest school in the country, and at that time the tuition was $75, and even USC or Stanford, man, were something trifle like $300 or $400 a semester. That was $75. That's one reason, and a fine school. It was, to me, maybe the best in the country. I got that from associates. Peer told me that. I went to work for Union Oil Company in 1933, which
exactly did you study at Berkeley?
Petroleum engineering. I got a B.S. in petroleum engineering, which is a good curriculum from the standpoint. You get the junior solid year in chemistry, geology, mechanical engineering, and they say it's a very demanding curriculum because if you were strictly electrical, you're in a gloom, strictly mechanical. But here you had to have the mental agility to pass the junior year flunking solids in chemistry, geology, mechanical engineering, hydraulics, and that it was a very tough, demanding curriculum. I might say that I cultivated a gentleman's seat. I graduated with a 1.002 grade point average, and that part of that was I really am a connoisseur of indolence. I think I enjoy indolence more than most people enjoy other kinds of things, particularly. Plus, I really, when I did understand in those classes, I loved some of the professors, and the subjects were beautiful. Some of the mathematics were entrancing. I loved what I was happy enough to learn. I worked my problem set, but I never stuffed just stuffing odd or facts that didn't really entrance me. And evidently, and I never crammed for anything, and evidently my dilettante something or other at least got me through with a 1.002 grade point average. And as a profession, I'm almost pretty good. I knew what I knew. I really knew it, and I really loved a lot of it, but I didn't know an awful lot. Enough to make good grades. Went to work for Union Oil.
What year did you graduate?
1933, and they signed NRA, and I got a job under the employment practices of NRA, where the employees went to work 4 days 1 week and 5 days the next, giving greater employment, and I was one of the greater employments, employable, employed by reason of the imposition of that shortened work week of 4 days 1 week and 5 days the next. And I was with them about 8, 9, 10 years.
What did you do?
Oh, on Dominguez Hill. After coming out of Cattleman Hills in 1935, really, I've spent, since 1935, I've been a petroleum engineer on the Englewood and Newport line. First at Dominguez Hill, extensively here at Seal Beach, Wilmington, some, enough to know quite a bit about Englewood, and also Huntington Beach and Newport Beach. So I have spent from 1935 to date exclusively from Newport to Englewood on the string of oil fields known as the Englewood Newport Line, a petroleum engineer. My superior, Sam Greenstalter, was given an elevation and became head of Union Oil Company in Texas, Louisiana. And he offered me to go with him, and I had a wife and two children, and a great fondness for indolence, and a few other things, and I didn't go. I'll be back. I'll come back. I didn't go to Louisiana. Well, that was my suicide in corporate. That was the end. So I had to do something else. Well, I became an apprentice to consultants in Los Angeles and learned the trade of appraisal. This is Jan Law and Ellis Air Law on Alameda Bay Peninsula at the time they were first putting in the marina. That would be about 1954, 52 and 53, we were the paddle tennis champion on Alameda Bay Peninsula of paddle tennis.
Doesn't sound very indoor.
Well, now that was different. That was different. That was fun. Well, there was a lot of... I don't know how to explain to you how the invalids... It didn't. I liked to swim, and I liked to play tennis, and I played tennis from the time I was 10 years old. And that isn't where my invalids... But there were certain kinds of things that I was indolent. This is to the impeccable expert witness, and that's Joe Ball, and I had 6 delightful years with Joe Ball. We really were compatible, and we really had some big wins with me as the expert witness, and Joe Ball being Joe Ball. I said to Paul, I said, well, my daughter didn't look that beautiful every day. And he said, well, good Christ, if you look that beautiful one day in your life, you've got someplace. I thought that was very nice of him to say that.
I think it's true.
Yeah, if anybody looked that beautiful in a month in their life, that'd be something, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Well, she is. She was. She's a computer programmer. Married to an ex-college professor, worked for Stanford Research Stanford University, until he developed asthma in Palo Alto. They now live in Mammoth Lakes, where his asthma is fine. This is my wife years go by with a horse and the dog and on the acre. We live on an acre up above Huntington Harbor. And we have a horse, 2 pygmy goats, midget goats, 3 dogs, 2 dogs, and some chickens and an acre. And we live near the Meadowlark Airport up on a kind of a rustic area. Now you know my whole life history.
Tell me about being a
friend
to the consultant.
Consultants, they had to be social enough to work up the business, to be in contact with the people who retained. And part of it, at that time, the university club that I belonged to was the hangout of petroleum consultants. And I would go there, and if I was there for luncheon and maybe to there till 2 o'clock. They knew I was at liberty and out of a job, and they would say, well, I've got a big job in and I have to go here, go there. And I would do the work under their tutelage, and they would sign it. I was ghostwriting. But they were telling me how they appraised properties. And they paid me no more than they would have paid a draftsman, which at that time, this would be 1942, 43, 44, was about $1.75 or $2, two and a quarter an hour. And it was a miserable pay, but I was truly, in the old-fashioned guild sense, a journeyman craftsman, traveling from master to master, learning the trade, and working for a pittance. I was also lecturer at the University of Southern California, about 4 years there in petroleum engineering, and it was through that the head of the department, Charlie Dodson, asked me if I wanted to go to work for Stanford Research, because they were starting up. Stanford Research was paid for by Procter & Gamble, Edison, Navy, City, you name it, lots of them, it says in the book, I believe. And it was a big cooperative effort, of which they spent $300,000, which in 1948, 1949 was an enormous sum for consulting service.
And how did you go from there to having your own business here?
Oh, along about 1955, there wasn't any more subsidence, and I didn't have a practice. I became an employee of Robert H. Garrison, the Hellman Estate, the next one over. And for 15 years, I was assistant manager, in which not only did he manage the Hellman Estate for the Hellman family, but he had the Fred H. Bixby here, and he had the Bolsa Gun Club, and he had Shell Alamedas, Llewellyn Bixby Jr., and Alamedas Land on Signal Hill, and he got to be of a certain age, and he gave me his consulting practice. That would be 1971. And ever since 1971, why, I've been here, taken care of. Well, we picked up a few number of accounts, and what makes it profitable enough is not really the quarterly annual stipend, but when our dear clients die, we do appraisals for a gift and estate tax purposes. Now, that, by tradition, pays more money. It pays significant money, I guess, because you have the responsibility of appearing before review and substantiating what you said. So it's serious. I've said that that we function that way, kind of like either the priest who ushers your soul past the gates and the undertaker who ushers your corpse here and there, or the appraiser who pushes part of your fortune past the internal revenue. And people have said, yes, I bet you the descendants like you better than they do the priest or the undertaker. And I said, well, I haven't thought about liking or not, but maybe they think my contribution is more lasting to their pleasure, I guess, than either the undertaker or the priest, if you don't mind being a bit sacrilegious about the whole thing. And that's how we made. Paul Sneddon was 28 years with Union Pacific and E.B. Hall. You know, Union Pacific there, the big hunk of Westminster. He came to work for him fresh out of East Des Moines, Iowa, in 1938. And he grew up a very competent fellow, as became a chief bookkeeper. I think he had a staff one time of 28 clerks and bookkeepers that he was the manager of E.B. Hall.